I'm Adam Coleman, inviting you to the fifth season of The Cosmic Library from LitHub. This season, we go on our tiniest reading adventure yet, into short stories in the U.S. But this too turns out to be almost all-encompassing.
I think short stories are essentially brief encounters with felt life.
That's Oxford literary scholar Andrew Kahn, who gives us a deep history of the short story. And we hear from The New Yorker's Deborah Treisman, who explains her work as an editor of short fiction.
You know, if you are melding with another person, you don't turn that person into you, but you get to know the ins and outs of that person. So, and it's sort of like that. I always feel involved with the stories.
We bounce around between the history and current life of short stories with the novelist Justin Taylor.
The nice thing about it going out of fashion is that it really frees you up to relate to it in a different way.
This being the Cosmic Library, we make sure to go way beyond U.S. short stories, too. Here's the Washington Post critic, Becca Rothfeld.
A lot of Kafka short stories, I think, gesture at or describe sort of nightmarish geographies or architectures.
And the actor Max Gordon Moore reminds us just how wild short stories can be. With a reading in its entirety of Wakefield, the intensely strange, classic Nathaniel Hawthorne story.
He had contrived, or rather he had happened to dissever himself from the world, to vanish.
Get ready for all that and more in a season about short stories, small windows into vast universes. It's season 5 of The Cosmic Library, available soon wherever you go for podcasts.
Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman. I am delighted to be sitting across from Eric Thomas today, or our Eric Thomas if you're searching for him on the web.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm like I said, I'm so starstruck to be here. I love this podcast.
Stop. Thank you. I'm gonna read your bio to you. Eric is a senior staff writer at Elle Online, where he's written the daily pop culture and politics humor column. Eric reads the news since 2016. As a playwright, his work has been staged around the country. Off the page, he's the long-running host of the Moth Story Slams in D.C. and Philly. He lives in Baltimore with his husband, the Reverend David Norse Thomas. Here for It is his first book.
Yes, indeed.
Yay. Congrats.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I love hearing the bio because it sounds like somebody that I don't know.
You're intimately connected, but...
Yeah, I'm like, oh, he sounds cool.
He does sound cool.
But also overrated.
But how do you started telling stories by literally telling stories, I assume.
Yeah, and that's really the DNA of the book. I don't think the book would the book as it stands would not be possible without like a long career in live storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, I was like calling myself like a professional storyteller, which is absolutely a thing that some people do. And I just sort of like dubbed myself that. I was like, now I'm a professional because I got a 1099, which I guess is what professionalism
is. I think that's all that you need.
But I saw an ad in the Philadelphia City Paper probably 10 years ago, maybe more, for a story slam, much like the Moth does, mm-hmm. or, you know, there's various organizations. This was for an organization called First Person Arts. And every story slam had a theme, and this theme was miseducation. And I just went in and told this story about meeting a drag queen named Miss Education after dropping out of college. And it was like, if I like didn't even include any of this in the book because I was like, this feels too perfect. But in that moment, I was like, whatever, this sounds great. And I was shocked. I was shocked that people were like interested in what I had to say. I had a long high school and middle school career of attempting to be a child star, like an actor.
Of course, yeah.
You know, like any normal person.
And you have lots of good musical theater references in your book.
I love musical theater. And that failing that, I thought, okay, well, there's no forward-facing position for me here.
Right.
And so storytelling opened up, you know, touched that same sort of like, you know, megalomania, but also that desire to be part of this kind of like this live magic. And so being able to like tell stories and figure out where people's energy sort of peaked and ebbed in real time was really educational to me. And really helped to guide me toward the essays that I think, you know, they're not written to be performed.
Right.
I do feel like there is the energy. I hope that the energy within them is the same as if we were, you know, like a little club and I was standing on stage, like trying to remember the words that I'd written.
Give me an example of something that started out as a story but is now an essay in your book.
So I think probably the most direct example is the story Ball So Soft, about being when I joined a gay softball league to, like most people do, to increase my masculinity.
Sure.
Yeah, that was my solution. And turns out I was too gay for the gay softball league, which is something I'm still working through in therapy. And so it was... It started off as just a like sort of short little story that I told like at Slams, like a 5-minute long story that wasn't – I didn't really realize what it was about. It was mostly the sort of climax of the story comes in the early stage version when I have to go to this like training day.
It's like remedial softball. Yes. For gay people.
Exactly. It was, that's exactly. Remedial softball for gay people is exactly what it was. I went to summer school, summer softball school in the summer. And so it was sort of climax there. And I didn't really know what to do with it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was like a funny story. It was kind of closer to stand up, I guess. And then I put it into a one man show that I was doing. And it spread out to maybe like 12, 13 minutes. And that was just about, it was about masculinity. Mm-hmm. and finding my place. And I thought, because I can be lazy sometimes, when I started working on the book, I was like, well, I'll just take the text from the one-man show, throw it in here,
right.
Nobody will know.
Boom.
Big bang, boom. Stage directions and everything. Nobody at Random House will know. But it actually, after realizing that, like, I have changed as a writer, it had mm-hmm, been, mm-hmm. you know, 7 years since that show, maybe five, that I wanted to give it a little bit more of a backbone. And I wanted to figure out how it could weave itself into the larger fabric of the story that I was telling.
Yeah. I mean, so let's step back a little bit and talk about your memoir is very much an essay collection about figuring out who you are mm-hmm. and being comfortable with who you are.
Yeah.
And that was a process.
Yeah.
How do you choose the moments from your life that make the meat of the book and are the examples, say?
I think half the moments, I feel like that's a really interesting question. I think half the moments started off as these, as moments that I felt were really ripe for either comedy or mm-hmm. ripe for tragedy that didn't feel unresolved. There are plenty of things in this book, or plenty of things that I would never even consider putting in this book. For a little bit of time, I was like, well, am I not a brave enough writer? Like, should I just open up a vein? And I don't know. I mean, like, my husband's a pastor, and right. he has this he learned from a colleague years ago. You know, they use a lot of personal reflections in their sermons.
Yes.
But the colleague said, like, don't bleed all over the congregation, which is graphic. But, like,
that makes sense.
It is sort of that's his way of thinking. You know, if he hasn't resolved it, or if it's something that is too messy, mm-hmm. then it doesn't go out to the larger body. Anyway, yeah, so I just look for moments of, like, of peak drama, you know.
Yes.
And then I ask myself, like, do these belong in this arc? And is this – and what is it really about?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I set out honestly to tell a bunch of really good stories. And that from that sprang the collection, which maybe it's backwards. I don't know how other people write books. I listen to, you know, these kinds of podcasts all the time, and I'm like, that sounds like magic. I don't know.
I think no one knows. I think if this is episode, I don't know, 40, everyone's kind of just like, I winged it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and like the collection is essentially chronological. And that was a large discussion with Sarah Weiss and Elena Stepler-Jolie at Ballantine, my editor and her assistant. And I really sort of pushed back initially, or resisted initially, making the collection chronological because I was very afraid of the term memoir and essays or memoir in general because I felt like I had to justify why somebody should care about what happened in my life, you know? Like I think about, you know, and I read memoir all the time and I know that like a lot of it's people's stories, lives, just, you know?
And if you tell it well, which you do, then people will want to read it.
And
that's a plug for your book right here.
Thank you very much. I didn't get it. And I would talk about it in therapy like every week. And my therapist, Brian, God bless him. I love him so much.
He's the first person you thanked in your acknowledgments?
Yeah, well, the first person's Beyonce.
Beyonce and your therapist. Those are like, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I love that you read the acknowledgments too.
I mean, that's my favorite part.
I really enjoy the acknowledgments as well. And I was like, is this a weird thing? But I don't know. I liked it.
No, it's very good. But you do – so, like, most of the collection, I would say, is chronological. But then you have a couple of things at the end that are about your past. And and then you end with, like, a kind of a little play.
Yeah. I can't believe they let me publish that. I honestly cannot. I was like, I'm going to write a little 10-minute play as an epilogue. And they're going to arrest me. but they let me put it in. And I wanted to – I'm very interested in time travel, you know. And I'm very interested in the future. And I – the act of writing a book to me is an act of, like, faith in the future. Because when I think of why, you know, why write a book, like, my only – you know, I want to be in community with people as I, like, read it and people like, send me emails or, you know, whatever happens when you write a book. You know, you get canceled. I don't know what happens.
I promise you. Well, I can't promise you that. But, like, I don't think you're going to get canceled.
I hope not. But I also thought about the way that I discovered books for much of my life. And that's in libraries. And also the Scholastic Book Fair. But mostly in libraries. And so I thought this thing is going to live in this universe for a long time, hopefully. And so then to believe that that's true and to think that that's worth it, then I have to believe that the future exists and that libraries exist and that we are still here. And so I wanted to tempt fate by writing a little play in which I got to speak to both people who I was in the past and people who I have yet to be. And it is, you know, it's not my favorite part of the book, but it is a part that brings me such exquisite joy because it feels foolhardy, you know. I've written myself as like a 70-year-old and I think 75 and then like an ancient person. And I was like, well, it's going to be real ironic if I die before I end the me in the book, you know. But also it's sort of like you have to believe in some version of yourself in the future.
Yeah.
Otherwise, why are you getting out of bed? Why are you doing any of the things that you do? And so that's the version of myself that I've chosen to believe in. And I think that I must implicitly have believed in this version of myself now in the past, even though if you asked him, he absolutely would not have told you that. But there's a reason that I'm still alive, and it wasn't a guarantee for a really long time. And so I wanted to carry that energy forward and not just have it be I worked through some tough things and life is fine. You know, I got a 401k. I wanted to
– Got better, boom.
I got better, problem solved, you know. Yeah. I wanted to acknowledge that, you know, there's this process and there's this continuum and there's so much mystery. And I'm not afraid of that mystery.
So. I love that. And – you even tell some of the worst moments in your life mm-hmm. with so much generosity. Like one of the things that really stuck out for me is that you at one point describe a fucked up incident from your childhood in school, and you use pseudonyms.
Mm-hmm.
And you decided to use pseudonyms that are fun because mm-hmm. why wouldn't you?
Right. I mean, well, here I didn't come to settle a score, you know?
Yeah.
I thought about it. But I also wanted – the thing – later on in that essay, I talk about how – you know, it's an essay about one of the features is a classmate calls me the N-word. And I ultimately get to the point in the essay where I am not – my reaction and my experience isn't like sort of being put on trial, and that incident isn't being used to define me. And that mm-hmm. was really sort of huge for me, and both sort of like textually and like psychologically.
Right.
And so if this is my story, then it's not just – it's not the N-word story. It's not the time that I realized that I would never always be some other class. It's a story that I am using to illustrate some point about me. And so therefore, I want to be in delight. And so the names that I give to these kids, you know, I think Prentice and Dora. Oh, my gosh, yes.
And Dora. Why wouldn't you?
Right. I was like, look. Who cares? Are they bad guys? Are they good guys? No, there's no antagonist here. Like, who cares? Who cares? I'm the person I'm trying to investigate.
It's your narrative.
It's my narrative.
You control it.
Right. And that's like, you know.
You name the characters.
I name the characters, and I say when it's over.
Yeah.
And one of the things with the editing of that piece also, there was, I don't know if it mattered. Well, I mean, it's true. It's what happened. There was this sort of flash forward to later on in the year. This moment of sort of like religious connection between me and that kid.
Mm-hmm.
We were both like, there was like an emergency situation that happened at school, and we both sort of like took to this little courtyard and started praying, and we were of different faiths. And it felt like it meant something. But I think it meant something like narratively, if I was trying to tell a story about, you know, so trying to write Green Book. but it wasn't something that – it was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't actually something that continued my journey. And
right.
So it was smart of, you know, my team to say this is probably not part of the story. So they really helped me to sort of excavate that too.
Do you think your impulse was to put a bow on it kind of?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean – and some of the best advice I got was, you know, you don't have to, like, on stage, you sort of want to make sure that people are leaving it with
a feeling. Want a resolution.
Right. And they were like, this is not a stage performance. So you don't have to toss the penny in the air, catch it, and then put it in your pocket, you know? And I was like, then where's the penny? Like, I got all these pennies in the air.
It could just be in your mind.
I suppose so. So that was freeing and terrifying. Because I love conclusion, but it was also, it was great to acknowledge that like, none of these things are going to be resolved. You know,
right.
Like I'm talking about otherness, and otherness and identity, and so my identity will continue to change. And like, as much as I say I'm the center of my own narrative, and as many books as I put out, there are definitely forces in the world that will say, you're on the sidelines.
Yeah.
You are an alternative. You're an other. And so I don't have to, that's not my job to catch the penny. And I think that's a relief, but also, you know, that's more of an intellectual thing, you know. Well, it's harder to put in practice, I should say.
Sure.
You know, in your own life, you know?
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the first time you went viral.
Oh, God. My mother called me while I was writing this, and she was like, are you going to put the thing with the newspaper in? And I was like, yeah, I think so. It's a good story. She's like, you should, because if they discover it, if they Google you and discover it.
Then you'll be canceled.
You'll be canceled. Oh, and she's my mother. She's wonderful, but she's also very afraid that I'm going to be canceled. So the short version of it is that I wrote an op-ed, satirical op-ed about Black History Month in my at the school newspaper for University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and it took the satirical point of view that Black History Month is not important, and that we spend too much time talking about Black history, and I don't believe that to be true.
What's satire?
That's what satire is, but I didn't really understand satire. and further, I didn't know anyone on campus per se, and there were no pictures accompanying the author pictures accompanying the article, so people took it seriously and thought that there was a white supremacist who was just like mouthing off in print. And this was in the 2002, so it's the early days of the internet, but it got passed around on the listserv, a number of listservs, but including on the listserv for the National Association of Black Journalists. And I had like over 1,000 emails in my inbox by the end of the weekend after it was published. I continued. We were so young and dumb, all of us on the newspaper. And we were like, this is so wild. It's so funny. We had a party. I composed. Oh, God. Ugh, I shouldn't say this. Who cares? We're like, let's do a drinking game. And you read your hate mail. And then we drink after. And like, I read like 2 emails. And I was like, this is sad. There's nothing to drink about. Like, it was like, because people hated me. And for good reason. They thought that I was saying the thing that we hear all the time, us about our identities and about our personal histories. So what's funny about that? So I had to learn in many different ways, in many hard ways, that I think it's powerful to be able to joke about the things that hurt me and that scare me, but I have to make sure that when I'm joking, that I am not causing further harm.
Yeah, I mean, but I think also, do you think now the internet is more, at least the media internet, is more attuned to the satirical tone? Like,
I think so. Although, just a couple weeks ago, gosh, I'm going to not remember any of the details, but there was a woman satirist who I think she writes as this sort of Southern anti-feminist woman character.
Yes, I know who you're talking about.
Okay, yeah. And like, I wasn't familiar with her work, but I think there were like snatches. There was one essay that went viral, and she was talking about not wanting Alexa in her house. That's what it was.
Yes.
Because she doesn't want any other woman in her house, which I think like is a funny premise to like, if you're doing it right. And I didn't read the piece, but I saw the conversation go from like, we're taking this woman seriously, to is she joking, to, well, she's a humorist, so she's probably joking, to this is bad humor, you know?
Right.
And so I do feel like the internet is like this contextless space.
Yes.
So anything you say, it feels like that moment, I don't know, like I guess maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when celebrities first started realizing that they could be taken out of context, right? Yeah. And they're like, oh, no, I was saying another thing. And we're like, we don't care. We're mad. And now we're all that person.
We're all that person all the time.
Right. I don't know. I mean, like, you put a lot of content out into the world. You tweet all the time, and you've got this podcast, and you're writing. Do you think about like, how do I cancel proof, you know, the things that I'm saying? Are you constantly thinking about that?
I am definitely constantly thinking about it.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you do?
There's nothing really I can do except try to be a good person and not fuck up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And try to be generous, and but, you know, It could happen at any moment to any of us.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Forever.
Yeah, which is wild to me. I don't know. I don't have another solution beyond that either. When writing humor, I'm always sort of aware that there is an implicit danger. You know, there's the top implicit danger of humor, which is someone saying, that's not funny, and you shouldn't say it.
Right.
Which sometimes you have to say, well, okay, we disagree.
Yes.
You know? I don't do stand-up for various reasons, mostly involving my inability to remember things. But I worked as a waiter in a stand-up comedy club for years after college, and it was such a great education to me. Mm. One, being able to respond to an audience, and two, looking at the way that people respond when they're getting pushback.
Right.
And when someone is saying, I don't like that, and learning how to receive that information.
Yeah.
And then figure out whether that information is applicable to you or
yeah.
not.
Are you going to take that critique?
Right. Yeah. And I think about that with the internet a lot because, you know, depending on what I write about, I'll get, you know, any number of wild tweets. And the impulse is always to sort of say, like, dunk, you're an idiot. Mm-hmm. Take your MAGA hat elsewhere or whatever. But I think that doesn't make me feel any better, you know?
Right.
I think I would prefer to be able to say, okay, well, where are we two humans talking, or are you just trying to score a point on me? And then if that's the case, then I don't need to play this game with you.
No.
Right?
That's a question for me, especially online, is do I respond?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any use in me respond? Am I going to make the conversation any better?
Right.
Any more clear by mm-hmm. responding?
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing that I talk about a lot, but that is in your book and worth mentioning, is that, yes, your column is hilarious.
Thank you.
Things would have been so much more funny.
Mm-hmm. I know exactly. Yes.
Had 2016 gone a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I started the column in the right after the DNC, right before the DNC.
Right. Which you covered for Elle.
Yeah. And that was my first sort of experience with like viral column experience.
Yes. But
I honestly thought that I would be writing like one or two columns a month that featured like Hillary Clinton as this Hermione Granger type figure and like Tim Kaine showing off his like exchange trip Spanish skills. And then I'd cover all the other things.
Yeah.
Because before, it wasn't a politics forward column. It was, if I was writing about Obama, it was about his bromance with Joe Biden.
Yes.
He sang at Malia's birthday party. I think that was the first column I wrote. And it was embarrassing. But I was also writing about like Beyonce and Rihanna
right.
and like random things that happen in celebrity world, which I still do.
Yeah, you do.
The election changed the energy around everything, obviously.
Yeah, know? I think it's – I mean, again, I've talked to a lot of writers at this point, and I don't think it's not influenced
yeah.
anybody's work.
Yeah, know? Yeah. And which, you know, was – it's very weird to think about with this book because I didn't – you know, when I was doing – meetings about the proposal, there were some people whose vision for the book was very much like in this resistance vein, like how to
hashtag, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Hashtag resistance. Yeah. And I was like, okay, what library does this get pulled down from the shelf on in the future?
Right, right,
because
right.
I want to believe that I exist in a future that is post-Trump, I also don't want to live in a future that it's like, oh, wasn't he kooky, you know?
Right, right, right.
Can you imagine? Well, we can because
yes,
we got yeah. the painter-in-chief.
the column has to become a different thing once Trump takes office.
Right. Yeah. He was impossible to ignore. I never wrote about him before the election. Like, I was like, man, he is not funny. I am doing something that's better and greater. And now, you know, the receipts are out there. I write about him once, twice a week sometimes.
Yeah.
Which is, well, you know, it is, I try not to treat him as a figure that is, I'm making good fun of. It's not like, it is, if he does something that's unavoidable.
Yeah.
And also not cravenly evil. There is this like sliver of space that's like, look, people will click on this. People want to read a take on this. I can do this in a way that feels responsible-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But it's everything is political, which I've always believed, you know, like the personal is political, you know?
Of course. It all is, mm-hmm. except it never kind of came together in this way before, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think people like to talk, contrarians like to talk now and say like, well, it's not, you know, you're putting your identity in this. And it's like, okay, well, I don't know what laws you're under, mm-hmm. but my identity is the thing that the law is touching.
Right.
You know? My identity is the thing that is either free or legislated to death. So I think it is weird to be in this moment that is capital P politics, capital L legislation all the time. One, because I feel like really out of my depth.
Yeah.
I've learned.
We've all become political scientists in the past 4 years.
It's true.
But you still write about pop culture.
I do.
Quite a bit. And so tell me just a couple of the things that you've recently been into, watching.
So my husband and I watched this show called The Expanse on Amazon. It's so good. It's based on a series of books by James S.A. Corey, which is a pseudonym for two other sci-fi writers. And I have not read the series, but I got really into The Expanse because we wanted something we could watch together. And David is not as voracious a pop culture consumer as I am. And so I wanted something that I wouldn't mind waiting for him. But I also was like, look, there's some things that I can't wait for you.
Right.
But it's a space adventure. But every season has a sort of different overarching theme. Like the last season was a Western in space.
Oh, amazing.
And then the first season is like a noir. And then there was one that's just like straight up sci-fi. And one's like an alien horror. It's really great.
Oh, I'm going to check that out.
Please do. Right now I'm watching The Circle on Netflix.
I'm laughing already.
it's a nightmare. It's like a dystopia. It's like a George Saunders story. But very enjoyable, and nothing bad happens so far. I have not yet seen the last couple episodes.
Oh, gosh, if they all die at the end, that would be terrible.
But I tell you, so, like, you know, these contestants are locked in these little studio apartments, and they can only communicate with each other through a flat screen text-based chat system. And they create profiles of their pictures, and some of them are catfishing. And the goal is to be the most popular in whatever way. It's so dramatic for people who are just screaming at the walls. But I also feel like it's a great approximation of what it's like to work from home.
Of course.
I just am screaming at the walls, talking to myself, and eating constantly, which they are also eating constantly. So I want to go on The Circle season two.
Amazing.
I don't care about winning. I just want some time to like write.
Snacks. And
read, and like work on a novel. And like
I love that.
Right?
Yeah.
I'll come out the other side of like, I don't think I won. I'm not sure. But look at this manuscript.
Oh my gosh, that would be the hottest new writer's residency.
Thank you.
Is The Circle.
I really think that we need to merge writing residencies and reality television.
That's amazing.
I mean, it's already so much drama. Uh-huh. Oh my gosh. And it's like it is. If someone's going to pay for you to, like, have time isolated from people, why not have it be a production company as opposed to a foundation or a farm or whatever? And they get their footage, and I get, again, my manuscript.
I love it.
Right?
I love it, Eric. we've solved a big problem today.
I really do think it, like you know, the idea of like who's paying for this. Well, if it's Magical Elves, the producers of Project Runway, there we go. You know.
And tell me, of course, what books you've been reading.
So I reread Morgan Parker's Magical Negro, honestly, like once a month, if not more than once a month.
Oh, she's the best.
She's the best.
And she just got a National Book Critics Circle nomination.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm so glad. I'm so glad that she's getting recognized. I love her. I love Magical Negro, and I love the There Are Things More Beautiful Than Beyonce. Jericho Brown's The Tradition I also really love.
Yes.
I like to revisit poetry a lot because I'm not very skilled in that area, and particularly poetry by Black poets and queer poets, because it helps me to create a vocabulary for things that I don't quite have vocabulary for.
I love that.
I also love I Know You Know Who I Am by Peter Kisbert. Mm-hmm. It's a book of short stories. All of the protagonists are queer people, and it plays with this the idea of lying, why we lie, why people believe our lies, why lying can be protective and or dangerous, and I love it because he attacks lying from so many different cool angles. Ooh. It's not just like, you know, it's not like, oh, just like the one narrative, like, oh, you know, queer people sometimes lead double lives and isn't that fascinating. It's like, okay, yes, basic level, but like all of us are constantly choosing in every moment, should I tell the truth? Should I lie? Should I tell the whole truth? What is the truth? Oh, it's so fabulous. I really, really recommend it.
I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank
this
you.
This was so fun.
Oh, this was a pleasure. Thank you.
Yay. Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.